There is no established precedent which absolutely requires that a trial court decide a question of its subject matter jurisdiction when presented with that question. There is certainly ample Supreme Court and appellate court authority for the both well-settled and logical proposition that a trial court that is presented with a question of its authority to exercise subject matter jurisdiction should turn to that question and resolve it promptly. There is no specific statutory or jurisprudential mandate to do so. And so one mechanism that oftentimes may be employed to avoid the question of resolving governmental immunity in a prompt fashion is for a trial court simply to refuse to rule on the question. We also must grapple with the fact that, again, to the extent that sometimes pleas to the jurisdiction in whatever form that they're presented are evidence-based, there has to be some allowance for the responding party to collect some evidence, and again, that in and of itself may create some delay. Right now, it appears as though mandamus may be the only avenue to require a trial court to address the question of governmental immunity where the trial court does not proceed to resolve it in a fairly prompt manner. One good example of this is Rule 202 depositions, pre-suit depositions. Courts have routinely held that governmental immunity cannot be raised to avoid a Rule 202 deposition, even though the nature of the claim described in the Rule 202 application may be one for which the governmental entity would be immune. And so it raises an interesting question of how a trial court has the jurisdiction to allow discovery in a suit where the governmental entity would be immune. But again, there's no statutory or definitive jurisprudential decisions that allow us to know how that would be resolved in more cases than not. They seem to be case dependent. Again, there is a requirement that's fairly well established now of clear and unambiguous language in a statute. The legislature has, in response to Supreme Court decisions over the last 20 years or so, taken up the mantle of writing legislative enactments where the legislature intends to waive immunity by expressly stating that governmental immunity is waived as follows. And we'll see that, for example, we talk about 271-152, excuse me, of the local government code that deals with contracts. Let's start first with tort claims. Section 101.021 of the Tort Claims Act is the only basis for a statutory waiver for claims of tort. It's basically divided into two sections: property damage, personal injury or death proximately caused by motor-driven equipment, and then personal injury or death, but not property damage caused by a condition or use of tangible personal or real property. So property damage is property damage, and it must be based upon the operation or use of a motor-driven vehicle or motor-driven equipment. And the employee would have to be personally liable if sued individually. The issues of who is operating the vehicle and what is a motor driven vehicle, or more importantly, motor driven equipment, continue to be litigated. Generally speaking, operating the vehicle means that the governmental entity's employee was actually manipulating the controls of the vehicle. However, there are reported cases where police officers are directing traffic, and the Court of Appeals has held that that is the operation of the vehicle for purposes of a waiver. Getting away from property damage, personal injury or death caused by the condition or use of tangible personal or real property. If the governmental unit would, if it were a private person, be liable under Texas law. Generally, condition means that a piece of equipment that was furnished was defective or that it was not suited to its intended purpose. Lowe versus Texas Tech from the Supreme Court, the case involving football equipment, it continues to provide a pretty good explanation of what condition means. Use means, according to the Supreme Court, actually bringing into use or employing a piece of tangible personal property, and the governmental entity's use of that property itself causes the injury. it's important to keep in mind that the property itself must be the actual proximate cause of the injury or death. Many cases fail on the argument that some property was involved or furnished a condition under which the injury or death occurred. This happens often in motor vehicle cases. A police car is parked on the side of the road. It's not being operated, and then the car is hit. Somebody in the back is injured. The courts generally take the position that that is not the motor vehicle causing, the operation of the motor vehicle causing the personal injury or death. Failure to use tangible personal property, since it's neither the condition nor the use of tangible personal property, is generally not actionable. Information is not tangible personal property. So records, failing to follow instructions, generally do not fall within the waiver of 101.021. Obviously, for that same reason, negligent supervision generally does not effect a waiver, nor does negligent training. When it comes to real property, Section 101.022 defines the duty. There are two types of defects. When there was a discussion earlier about preserving error, there was a lengthy discussion about Payne versus State Department of Highways. Payne is also a very important case because it did a very good job of explaining the distinction between a premise and a special defect. Most defects, except in fact, except those that are statutorily defined as special defects, are premise defects.